Thank you. Today we are going to depart from our study in the New Testament to address an issue that is important in the American Christian Church right now. And I want to tell you how we are going to be dealing with that here at Mosaic Church. Let me throw a few slides up on the screen to address what we're going to be talking about. You see up on the screen there, two lists of characteristics. The left side, competence, power, efficiency, achievement, skills, proving oneself, all the way down to goal-oriented, self-sufficiency, success, and competition. On the right side, love, communication, beauty, relationship, support, help, nurturing, feeling, sharing, all the way down to personal expression. Now, by a show of hands, who here believes that the left set best characterizes Jesus Christ and his true followers? And raise your hand if you believe the right set best characterizes Jesus Christ and his true followers. Excellent. Thank you. Now, what is interesting about that is these characteristics were not drawn from Scripture to come up with these lists. In fact, those lists came from this book right here. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus, where Dr. Gray went through and identified characteristics that are normally found in women and normally found in men. And what he discovered then was that the left set was primarily the manly description of characteristics, and the one on the right is the womanly one. Now, the interesting thing is, since when did the American church decide that being a Christian and following Christ comprised womanly characteristics? Because if you look in the Bible and you look at the characters in the Bible, particularly the disciples, Jesus himself, you see characteristics like accomplishment and objective and competition and success and achievement all throughout the Scripture. So somehow or another, we've kind of changed things in the American Christian Church. Let me show a few other statistics for you. Average attenders at church, adult crowd, 61% female, 39% male. 25% of the married church-going women go without their husbands. How about this one? Women in church are more likely to attend Sunday school in small groups. They comprise 2/3 to 3/4 of the volunteers. They are 75% of the folks who buy Christian products. So what do you think then as far as the makers of Christian products when they're trying to decide how to make things? Who are they going to tailor those products to? Why do you think Jesus looks the way that he does in our Sunday school curriculums, for example? Women outlead, outpray, outdisciple, outwitness, and outgive men. In other words, you're not just cheeks in seats, you are active in our church, which is wonderful, okay? But on the other hand, let's talk about the men. Fewer than 30% of the boys being raised in church are going to remain faithful through their teens and into their 20s. Men 18 to 35 in most churches comprise less than 5%. Now, we could say, well, men are less religious. Okay, that's why they're not here. Well, that's not true. Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, they have no gender gap like we're talking about here. And if you look at Muslim men, you find men who are committed to their faith completely. So are they less interested in God? No. 90% of U.S. men believe in God. 5 out of 6 call themselves Christian, but 1 out of 6 is going to be able to be found in church on any given Sunday. Men love God, but they want little to do with the church. Now, let me address what's going on in this church, because if you look around here, you see some pretty good men in this church. Good men, manly men, okay? That's great. But the guy who has been putting these statistics together, who wrote the book Why Men Hate Going to Church, addresses that head on. And he says, certain kinds of churches attract good men. Certain kinds of churches being startup churches. Now, for the last few years, we've been building a church here, Mosaic Church. And most of the men that are in this church are involved in that. When you have a startup church, you get men that like accomplishing a goal, working toward achieving success. That draws those kind of men. But if you came into this church today with your family for the very first time, and you looked around, you'd say, wow, all these things are already happening. Interest groups already exist. There's a great band. There's a building. This is all pretty good. But you wouldn't have, and so we might fall into the kind of statistics that some of these other churches are. falling into with regard to their men. And we want to be intentional about our ministry here at Mosaic. We do not want to just take this all for granted. And so later on this morning, Brody Stevens is going to come up and he's going to talk to you about our men's ministry and how you guys can get involved. But right now, I want to introduce our guest speaker this morning. Now, John Bishop went to Annapolis, the U.S. Naval Academy. He was a United States Marine, and then he went to work for one of the largest financial corporations in America. He currently lives in Annapolis, Maryland, and he has a ministry called Bravo Zulu, where he travels around the country speaking to men. Now, he's been to talk to our men twice already in the last couple of years, and the last time he was here, the guys all said, we got to get him back to speak to the congregation. So, ladies and gentlemen, this morning, I'd like to introduce Mr. John Bishop.
Thank you, mate. Well, good morning. First thing I'd like to do is to thank Stu and the men here in the fellowship for the opportunity to come back and be with you again and to share some ideas that I am continuing to work on and to develop. But since we're in the state of Florida and this is kind of one of the retirement capitals of the world, I thought I'd tell you a story about a guy came down here and retired, and all of his working career he had wanted to own a Corvette. And so he got down here and just got the Corvette and was out driving one day, and he thought, well, he'd just kind of open this thing up a little bit and just see what it would really do. And he did, and sure enough, the lights began to flash in his rearview mirror, and he thought for a second, I might be able to outrun this guy. And then he decided against it, and so he pulled over, and the state trooper came up and asked that traditional question, do you have any idea how fast you were going? And the old guy said, well, I'm pretty sure it was in triple digits. And the officer said, well, that's correct, he said, but I tell you what, you tell me one I haven't heard, and I'll let you go. Well, that the old guy thought for a minute, and he said, well, my wife ran off with a state trooper about 5 years ago, and I thought you were bringing her back. With that, the trooper said, have a nice day. Well, I'm on a mission, folks. I'm on a mission here at Stu's request to do what I can to help launch this men's ministry or ministry to men. And in my opinion, as I look across the landscape of the country, there's probably not a more significant or more needed ministry today because we are so lacking across the culture in good, godly, masculine leadership. And so this is a dynamic that Stu and the men here are feeling, and they want to begin to pull the men together and have asked me to come down and help kind of stimulate this and spur this on. So I'm on a mission to do that. I'm going to run through quite a bit of information, and hopefully some of it will stick. And then maybe if it doesn't, Stu will invite me back. First thing, probably the most important thing, folks, we're at war. I don't want anybody to leave this room not understanding we're at war. And I want to tell you where I get this. I'm not talking about the Middle East. I'm talking about spiritual warfare. I'm talking about the thief come to kill, to maim, and destroy. And the thief is killing, he's maiming, and he's destroying. It's active, it's present, evil is alive and well. We see it in the paper every day. You can't turn the television on and not experience it up front, close. But I want to give you a feel for where this comes from and why we have to deal with it. Genesis 2:17 is where God gives the command to Adam not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Folks, that command presupposes the existence of evil. Otherwise, the command doesn't make any sense. And evil is the result. It's the consequence of this cosmic anarchy that had erupted in the heavenlies as Satan rebelled all before creation. So there was warfare before the garden. We are born and born again into a world at war. Then in Genesis 3:15, God comes back into the garden to confront Adam and Eve. And when he speaks to the serpent, he says, I'm declaring war against your seed and her seed. So there was war before the garden. There was war in the garden. And then I'd point you to a number of passages, but the one I pick is Revelation 12:17, where by the way, we've all just gone through the Advent season. I would encourage you to go back and reread Luke chapter 2, the Christmas story. get a fresh familiarity with the angels, the wise men, the shepherds, the manger, what we see in the physical dimension in Luke 2 about what was happening at the birth of Jesus. But then immediately flip over and read Revelation 12, and it will show you what was going on in the spiritual dimension as all of creation moved to protect Jesus at his birth against the assault and warfare and attack of Satan. And the last verse of 12:17 says, Satan went away enraged to make war against the sons of men and those who hold to the testimony of Jesus. So there's war before the garden, in the garden, and ever since the garden. And if our worldview does not factor in, does not include the reality of warfare, then our worldview is not going to serve us correctly. Now, in war, probably the most critical thing in war is to be able to identify, acquire, and bring your resources to bear on the right targets. If you can't do those three things, you're not going to win the war. It's one of the reasons we have the problems we have in the Middle East. Difficult to identify the enemy. They don't wear uniforms. They don't have insignias. They don't have identifying markers. Then when you do identify them, typically they're in a school or mosque, and it makes it very difficult for our gazillion-dollar resources to be deployed. So it's a very, very insidious thing if you can't identify and bring your resources to bear on the right targets. Well, in this warfare, I'm going to give you just three targets. There are several, but I'm going to just focus on three. The first target is the church. Here's what I mean by that. Jesus, in the Gospels, only says two things about the church. He only says two things. And just out of curiosity, do any of you remember what those two things are?
Hell will not prevail against it.
Matthew 16, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Matthew 18, he says, if a man is in sin, go to him. If he doesn't listen, take a couple others. If he still doesn't listen, take him to the church. That's all Jesus says about the church in the Gospels. They're the bookends, I believe, the brackets around which we need to understand the rest of the teaching about the church. It's a body, it's a bride, it's a city. But Jesus' statements are instructive to us that his church is an instrument of warfare and a place of discipline. And we need to understand that. Now, Satan, as a result of those statements, has been put on notice. Satan has been alerted by Jesus that I'm coming against you at some point in the future. I'm bringing the church, and it's through the church that I'm going to deal with all the evil in the cosmos and in creation. So the church is a target. Now, the problem is that when we all signed on to follow Jesus, whether we realized it or not, we signed on to be warriors. We signed on to participate in this battle against the gates of hell, against the evil that's in the creation and by extension into the cosmos. The second target, women. When Satan came into the garden in Genesis 3, he didn't come in there after having flipped a coin saying, heads I talk to Adam, tails I talk to Eve. He didn't come in there first come, first served. He came in there specifically going after one thing in the life of Eve, and I believe he went after her glory. Ladies, men, the crown of creation is the woman. Woman is the greatest illustration that the best was saved for last. And as a result of that, women have a unique glory. It's theirs as the crown of all of creation. But there's another thing. In the New American Standard, it says that he formed Adam, but he fashioned Eve. There's a different word. From a malleable piece of clay, it's much easier to form Adam. But I think he's saying something to us significant in taking a rigid piece of calcium to fashion Eve, more involved in that process. And I believe that as the Lord was fashioning Eve to present to Adam, he was also thinking downrange to the day when he would present the church to the second Adam as the bride of Christ. So women, you enjoy a special glory for being the crown of all creation and the representation of the bride of Jesus. It's yours. And men, part of our responsibility is to protect that and not cheapen it, but to respect it and to admire it and to encourage them, the ladies, not to let it go. It's theirs. Third target, men, us. And from this point forward, if the ladies will bear with me, I really want to focus strictly as much as I can on the men and the issues that we have to deal with. For us, the target, I believe, is our work. For women, it's their glory. For men, I believe Satan targets our work. In Genesis 2:5, it says there was no shrub or plant or herb to cover the ground because God had not sent the rain. And then there's this little phrase, and there was no man to work the ground. 10 verses later, he creates Adam and puts him in the garden to work the ground. Men, I believe our most fundamental created purpose as men is to work. However, remember, we're at war. There is a war going on, and the meaning, the purpose, the dynamics of work have all gotten corrupted. Today, work is a job. It's a career. It's a path to retirement. It's all of a whole bunch of things that God never intended it to be. I believe God's intent before the fall for work was twofold. Number one, it was to be a partnership. He wanted man, he wanted Adam, and I think by extension, each of us, to partner with him in caring for creation and exercising authority over it. He intended it to be a partnership. For example, he creates the garden, and then he puts Adam in there and says, now I want you to take care of it. We're partners. Then he comes along and says, look, I'm going to create all these animals, but because we're partners, I want you to name them. And the third one, he says, I gave you life, and now we're going to be partners, and I want you to extend life by being fruitful and multiplying. He intends for us to be his partner. And one of the ways I like to illustrate that is this little cup. Imagine being in your late teens, early 20s, and going to the carpenter shop every day to work with Jesus. What would your day be like? I'd argue it'd be transformational. I'd also argue that he would run that carpenter shop just like any other carpenter shop. He wouldn't use any Holy Spirit magic to extract a broken nail or sand the wood or glue the furniture. You'd still hit your thumb with a hammer, probably still be tempted to swear, still have splinters, sawdust, but when you went home at night, you'd go home with a full cup because you'd spent the day with Jesus. And out of that full cup, you'd love your wife, you'd love your children, you'd be involved in the community, you'd be involved in the synagogue, you'd be involved in extending the kingdom. And the next day, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you'd be right back there again because you're going to get to spend the day with Jesus, partnering with him. Now, men, I believe that's how we should look at work. When you roll out in the morning and head out the door or down the freeway, the first thought ought to be, Lord, what are we going to do today? We're partners in caring for this little piece of creation that you've assigned me to. That transforms, for most folks, how they view how men view where they spend the bulk of their waking hours. But there's another purpose to work, and that work is a context for worship. In the Hebrew, the word for work and worship is the word avodah. It is the same word. So work and worship are really aspects of the same thing. I believe as we partner with God, and we then get to see him in operation, see him in the work world, watch him work. What's a response that you're most likely to make when you see God in action? I'd say worship. Wow, Lord, amazing, incredible. You're great. You worship as you see him work. And so our work becomes a context for worshiping him as he's working with us in that day. So, twofold purpose for work, partnership, live out of a full cup, and then it's a context for worship. Now, Satan's goal is to disrupt that, to damage it, to sabotage it, to destroy it, to prevent this partnership, to rupture the partnership, to create alienation in the partnership. And he certainly doesn't want the living God to be worshiped. So he works hard to prevent that from happening. And here's one of the ways I think he does it. And I'd like to illustrate it using a bald eagle. Many of you have probably seen in real life in this part of the country, or maybe on video, a bald eagle as it soars across the valley or rides those thermals. And when you see that, are you not constrained to give some glory to that eagle's creator? It's a magnificent thing to see. Wow, look at that, or let's take a picture. Those are all expressions of glorifying the creator. But most folks don't think about the Lord's response when he looks down on that eagle as it soars across the valley. And folks, I'm convinced that when the Lord looks down and sees this eagle soaring across the valley, the Lord goes, yes, look at that. I designed that. I created that. It's functioning the way I designed it to function. And therefore, the Lord gets glory. Not only does he get glory, but he gets pleasure when his creation functions as the way it was designed to function. And that, folks, for me, is the heart of spiritual warfare. The heart is revolving around the question, who gets the glory? Satan wants it, and if he can't have it, he doesn't want God to have it. So his goal is put that eagle in a zoo or cage or chicken coop or some way to constrict and restrict its abilities so that it doesn't soar, so that it can't read a newspaper at a half mile. He wants to constrain it. Now, I think this is what happens to men. As we get lured or drawn into a work life, a work style for which we were not designed. And we may have gotten pushed into it by the expectation of our parents. We may have pulled ourselves into it because we were pursuing money or prestige or power. But lots of ways we wind up getting there, or a lot of ways the devil is successful at getting there. And let me show you how successful he is. I want you to think about three things. And I want to put a percentage on the total. How many men in the circle of men that you know basically hate what they do to make a living? Or number two, tolerate what they do to make a living? Or three, wish they could change what they do to make a living? If you add those three up, what kind of a percentage would you put on the total? Anybody? 70, 80, 90, somewhere typically north of 70% of the men get up every morning, get ready for work, commute to work, work, come home from work in one of those three categories. Now, what's the impact on the heart and soul of a man who is caught in a working environment that he hates, tolerates, or wishes he could do differently? It's destructive. My way of describing that is he is, in effect, a square peg in a round hole. He's not fitted for what he's doing. And when you have a square peg in a round hole, you get friction. And this friction is what is so destructive to the hearts and souls of men. Because when a man's caught in friction, Satan knows this, by the way, if he can keep a man in friction long enough, he can destroy the man. Friction created the Grand Canyon. Nothing can withstand friction over a long period of time. So here's some of the consequences of being caught in this friction environment. Number one, it destroys a man's sense of generosity. Reason? He's caught in this friction. He's feeling it, and Satan's right there saying the way to get out of this is to build a fortune, build a portfolio, become rich, and then what? You won't have to work. Now, I'm not going to ask if any of you have thought that, but have you not heard that said by others? Well, there's two problems with that, folks, two serious problems. Number one, it's an act of disobedience. God's intent that we would partner with him, co-labor with him, and care for his creation, that command has never been rescinded. He always wants a partnership. He always wants a relationship. He always wants his creation cared for. So it's an act of disobedience. Number two, the love of money is the root of all evil. But folks, the pursuit of money is the root of all foolishness, and many are hurt thereby. It's my paraphrase of 1 Timothy 6. So trying to get rich in order to get out of the friction sends a man off on a trajectory that is endless, okay? Number two, I think it's the primary source of passivity in men. Reason? You think about this. You spend 8, 9, 10, 12 hours a day friction. When you come home, you're exhausted. You don't want to engage. You want to veg. So passivity is a result of this friction. I think it's a primary source of the addictions that men get involved in, especially pornography. Because this friction creates a temptation. Satan's right there. Say, well, here's a way to get a little relief. Click, 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 and the guy's trapped again. Now, men, I want to encourage you, don't fight pornography. That's a losing battle. What I want to challenge you to do is to live out of a full cup. If you're living from a full cup, how much room is there in there for pornography? None. The way to battle that addiction or any other influence that's inappropriate is to begin to live with a full cup, spending your time with Jesus. Okay? Now, here's the challenge. First thing, I want to encourage you to recognize, to believe, heartfelt belief that you are uniquely designed and created. Your days are numbered, your hairs are counted, your steps are ordered, you're bought with a price, He knows you by name. At the end of the line, you get a new name that only He and you will know. Down to your fingerprints and DNA, we are all utterly, fantastically, marvelously, wonderfully unique people. In fact, at your conception, the creative genius of the universe found expression. Every person in this room is an expression of the unique genius of the living God, creating us in His image, but creating us differently. Next, I'd like you to believe that your purpose in life flows out of your design. That eagle's purpose, in one sense, is to soar. It is not to go down to the beach and hop around like one of those little terns and dig up sand crabs. It's designed to function in a certain way, and your purpose flows out of that design. Well, here's some applications. Some of you may be ready for this, and some of you are not. That's okay, but I want you to at least think about it, maybe for those who are ready to get engaged in it. The first thing is I want you to become part of a small group. And I want to stress this. In the military, every aviator has a wingman or a co-pilot. Every ranger has a ranger buddy. Every SEAL has a swim buddy. Every soldier has a foxhole buddy. Every Marine has a fire team. We never send men into combat by themselves. Never an option. But we do it in the church and we do it in ministry all the time. And I want to challenge that you get together with a little band of brothers, and I'm saying 3 to 5, keep it small. Because there's two purposes for this idea of a little band of brothers. Number one is protection. That wingman, that aviator who has a wingman, has somebody flying at 6 o'clock. That foxhole buddy has somebody else, another set of eyes, another set of ears to listen, to be attuned to what may else be going on out there. But there's also another reason why you have a buddy, because if you fall, there's somebody there to pick you up, to carry you if you need to. Ecclesiastes says, woe is the one who is alone when he falls and has no one to pick him up. So we need this little band of brothers because I think it's not only, it's a strategy. It's a way of thinking about what it means to journey with Jesus through life. He did not intend for us to do it by ourselves. Then they have an agenda. Got a very specific agenda for this small group. Number one, I want you to come together and pray. And the prayer I want you to pray is to claim the promise that Jesus gave us when he said, if two or three, a handful, a small group, get together in my name, I'll be there. And men, I think you can be bold about this and say, Jesus, we expect you to show up. We're here in your name. Now, will you please fulfill your promise and be with us? Then when you get together, the agenda is to be with him and with each other. And then read the scriptures, but specifically read the gospels. Start with the red letter gospels, read the words of Jesus, and then when Jesus begins to speak about some event in another part of the scriptures, go read what he has to say. Go read what Jesus was talking about. Let the gospels introduce you to the rest of scripture. Then the next thing is tell your story. 3, 4, 5 guys, get together, tell your stories, and start with your conception. I know in a group like this, and the group that's been here before me, not everybody's conception was positive. You may have been unwanted, unplanned, illegitimate, who knows? But that had an effect on you, and that effect moves through your life. But tell your story so that other men know this. I can now share this because my mother is gone. She's with the Lord, But when I was 30 years old, my dad had been dead for about 13, 14 years. I was 30 years old. I was off active duty. I was a grown man. And my mother, when I went home one time, standing around the kitchen, disclosed to me that my father had paid all the money, made all the arrangements, and put all kinds of pressure on her to have an abortion. And I'm standing there at the kitchen counter thinking, and I'm going to just tell you what I thought. What the hell am I supposed to do with this information? But it was part of my story, and it came out. And because I have a band of brothers, I have some men around me, as they began to see how that might play out inappropriately, I had feedback. I had guys that understood and could help process the damage that that was. I was rejected before I saw the light of day. So that's just part of my story. And there's guys in here whose stories are 10 times worse than that. And it may still be an untold story. So tell your stories. Begin to build trust. Begin to build love and acceptance in that little group. And then, together, as a little band of brothers, steward, shepherd your stories into the great story. This incredible narrative that God is telling across all of history. The story of redemption and the story of restoration. You know, Abraham's gone, Moses is gone, David's gone, Peter, James, and John are gone. It's now our time. This is our time to participate and to lead and to contribute in this great narrative that God is telling for all mankind. And he's calling us as men, I think, to be clear about the story, to be clear about what we've called to do. Then I want you to become skillful at using the weapons of our warfare. The Apostle Paul says the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. He doesn't say we don't have weapons. We do have weapons. They're just not carnal. So I'm going to give you my definition of a weapon. A weapon is anything that destroys your enemy's ability to wage war against you. A hunting rifle is a hunting rifle when it's pointed at a deer. A hunting rifle becomes a weapon when it's pointed at your enemy. Now, in this spiritual battle, spiritual warfare, I'm going to just give you three weapons that we have, and I want you to become skillful at these. And you're going to need each other in this little group to do that. Number one, forgiveness. Forgiveness is a weapon because it destroys the enemy's ability to wage war against me through unforgiveness, through bitterness, through alienation, through hostility. When I went through a process and forgave my father, I was healed. I was free. I haven't had to trek through life dragging all this Samsonite baggage because of his rejection. Forgiveness freed me, and it destroyed the enemy's ability to keep me in bondage to that baggage. Generosity is a weapon. Generosity destroys the enemy's ability to wage war against you through this pursuit of wealth or through the deceitfulness of riches or through the ensnares and entanglements of stuff and materialism. It frees you from that and keeps the enemy from enslaving you. But your generosity also destroys his ability to keep other people in the grinding of poverty because your generosity frees them. So it's a weapon. It destroys the enemy's ability to wage war against us. And number three, a clear conscience is a weapon. When you have a clear conscience, it destroys the enemy's ability to wage war against you through guilt, through shame, through humiliation, through embarrassment. And you get a clear conscience by doing number one, asking for forgiveness, repenting and asking for forgiveness. It's available. Paul says, I strive hard to always keep a clear conscience. So those are weapons, and I'd like for you in these little groups to become skillful at using those. Begin to change the spirit that you have maybe towards a father or somebody in the past through forgiveness. Engage in this battle with those weapons. And finally, here's my real challenge to you. In the little group, don't talk about it. What's shared in the group stays in the group. And I'm going to ask the ladies specifically, don't ask questions about what's going on in the group. Give your husband, your father, your son, give them the opportunity to experience what some of the things up here and some of the stuff that's going to come, to experience what it means to build a loving, trustful relationship with another man, a brother, a band of brothers. But what I want to see happen, though, I'd like to see happen over this next year, is that slowly I'd like to see the moms and the wives and the daughters begin to approach the pastor and say, you know what? I don't know what's going on in that little group that my husband or father or son is in, but I really like what I see. The less you talk about it, and the more you live it, the more transformational it will become. And the more transformational it becomes, the more others will see it. And I'd like the word to filter to your pastor that your life is being changed because you're in this little group, this little band of brothers. I'd like to leave you with this quote from Thomas Brooks. Thomas Brooks said, "There are only war veterans in heaven, those who fought the good fight for the kingdom of God." And my call, my challenge to each of you is to get off the sidelines, get on the front lines, get involved in the battle. Let's link together and let's fight the good fight for the kingdom of God. Thank you.